I'll carry over and apologize for being late. I said that wouldn't happen on the first day, but this is the first time it's happened. We have some folks who have some urgency in their schedule, so I'm going to open a couple of hearings and get their testimony, and then we'll get back into some more rational order. So let me open a hearing on Senate Bill 656 and ask Senator Carter and Representative Butler to join us. We'll have some more of the committee along in a minute. Of course he can. Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. You'll be hearing Senate Bill 656.
Well, let's just get this testimony, and then we'll go back open them up and start in a more regular way.
You'll be hearing from Senator Carter.
Senator Carter, is he coming here or there?
Thanks, sir. He didn't have a chance. He had to go to another meeting.
Okay.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Margaret Carter, House District, Senate District 22, North Northeast Portland. For the record, I'd like to make one statement, if there's a statement I'd like for you to hear. And that statement is that once vision is lost from glaucoma, it is forever gone. It is not restored, and it does not come back. Glaucoma is the leading cause of blindness in African Americans. And, Mr. Chairman, 3 years ago, as to why this bill is before you here today, is not because of two warring factions. This bill is before you today because 3 years ago in North Northeast Portland, I had a screening. And in this screening, there were lots and lots of older Americans who happened to have been African American and some Hispanic who had very serious problems with glaucoma. Not only did we see it in many times for those people who had been having care, and thank God for early access to the kind of care they did have, but most of them were on their way toward very serious problems with glaucoma. It is said that African Americans, seven times more often than not, or than non-African Americans, have this common disease in their eyes. It is a devastating disease in our community, and Senate Bill 656 asks that an optometrist treating patients for glaucoma to consult under certain conditions, not refer, not father or mother may I, but to consult under certain conditions if it progresses despite the use of a single glaucoma medication. If more than one medication is required to control the glaucoma, or if a secondary glaucoma develops. These are reasonable considerations, reasonable parameters for the protection against a disease that, once blind, can never be restored. In my family alone, there are seven people with glaucoma, and I am pretty much disposed as a result of my DNA. The finality of the potential result from glaucoma absolutely requires our caution. That's why this bill is before you today. That's why I feel that this is good public policy. The finality requires total caution to avoid total blindness. Blindness affects the individual. Blindness affects families, communities, employability, the budget, resources that we have to allocate. And it is a great thing, Mr. Chairman, that we have early access to dealing with this whole issue in terms of optometrists and then consultation when there are serious, more serious effects with with ophthalmologists. Senate Bill 656 is a precaution, a wise bill of precaution, and I urge your committee to act today to help with this issue that is affecting so many people that that are African Americans and that are low-income people in this community. Needless to say, when we did this screening, there were as many low-income whites as there were blacks at this screening. So it's a low-income issue. It's a public policy issue. And I beg of you to not look at the issue that we so much face it as legislators, and that is this whole issue of scope of practice. This is a serious issue that I'm bringing before you today. It's not just a scope of practice issue. Thank you very much.
Other questions or something like that?
I have a question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you so much, Senator Carter. This is indeed an important issue. But try as I may, I can't quite figure out what the goal is with the language on the first page compared with the language that's taken out of the existing law. Because under this bill, it requires a consultation if A, B, or C. But the language that's taken out of existing law required a consultation in every instance prior to instituting treatment. So I'm trying to figure out where the, if this is in fact going to be better than having a consultation in every instance prior to treatment, and how that balance was made to take out the initial consultation and put it in only in some certain circumstances.
Representative, I would love to be able to answer that question for you, but I'd like to bring our technical people on to answer
thank
the question
you.
For you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we'll do that later then.
Thank you.
Senator Carter, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Butler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and may I just again congratulate you, Mr. Chair, and your Vice Chair on the honors that you have received today on behalf of the healthcare industry, both in Oregon and the United States. It's a great honor to be able to be with you. My name is Tom Butler. I represent House District 60, and I told you at the beginning of the session you're always going to get tired eventually hearing me say this, but it's the largest district in the state of Oregon. Consequently, it's the most rural.
And it's in the Mountain Time Zone.
And it's in and the most of my constituents live in the Mountain Time Zone, Mr. Chair. That's exactly right. Oregon starts its day in Niagara County. I want you to know that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I have lined up two of the optometrists in my district to be able to call in and offer testimony, but in preparation for that, I wanted to just let you know that in a discussion of the two most populous counties that I represent, that's those being Baker County and Malheur County, I've visited with my optometrists and their representatives, and they feel like that they have a very excellent relationship with the ophthalmologists, the very few ophthalmologists, I might say, that we do have in rural Oregon. I don't have any ophthalmologists serving some of my counties, and so where I have optometrists available, those folks do consult with ophthalmologists and do an excellent job.
Excuse me just for a moment.
Yes, sir.
We've opened this hearing. As soon as Representative Butler testifies, we'll close this hearing and open up 34 so you two can testify.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In that process, the optometrists feel like that it would be a tremendous disservice to the to rural Oregonians to be required to get the additional consultation and the out-of-district consultation that they would have to go through in many instances in rural Oregon. I have prepared and passed out to each member of the committee today an A2 amendment, which should be in your packet with regard to Senate Bill 656. And the A2 amendment, which down in Legislative Council, I think I order this on almost every bill that comes forward with some major change of how we're going to make a new pattern of one size fits all in Oregon. I just need you to know that one size does fit one in Oregon, and usually it's for the more metropolitan counties. And what the A2 amendment does is to say that if you do pass this bill, please consider that for counties of less than 50,000 people, where I may not have, where I do have optometrists, but I may not have access to the ophthalmology that would be necessary, direct ophthalmology, the optometrists continue to consult on a regular and ordinary and customary basis with excellent results and excellent exchange of ideas. And so what this amendment does is that it asks that if you proceed, that optometrists practicing in counties with population of 50,000 of less than 50,000 residents would be exempt from the additional consultations of sending their patients out for the direct one-on-one in order to change the medication, add an additional medication, or modify the treatment. Now, in that regard, I think that you would hear from these optometrists that would tell you also that when they do have hard cases, they recognize them, and they immediately will begin to consult. And in Baker City, there is an ophthalmologist, and in Ontario, there is an ophthalmologist. But when I go to Hines, Burns, Haines, Powder River, those kinds of places, Sumter, the difficulty is that we're then dealing with changing a time zone and driving the bend in order to get these folks to the next. And many times that is not just expensive but very difficult with people who are going through eyesight issues. And the optometrists feel like that they have an excellent relationship with the ophthalmology community in that they don't feel like that this is as much of a problem as perhaps it is where we have greater populations of African Americans and folks who are more who lend themselves more to having glaucoma than perhaps the ranch and farm and rural communities may have.
Any questions of Representative Butler?
Representative Butler, you mentioned dash two amendments. I don't see those. Have those been prepared?
Here's one.
Mr. Chair, Representative Vice Chair Richardson, it's a three-liner that just basically inserts that in there that indicates that the provisions of this bill would not mandate this same kinds of requirements in counties of 50,000 or less.
Thank you. Do we have the phone number? We're going to switch bills here, but do we have the phone numbers of your folks, and will they be available for a while?
Yes, Marjorie does. I understand, Mr.
Great.
Chair.
Mr. Chair, could I ask a quick question?
Absolutely.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Butler. If I read current statute correctly, and I'm looking at page 2 of the bill, line 33, there is a requirement that prior to treatment with anti-glaucoma medication, optometrists shall consult with an ophthalmologist or other doctor of medicine. Do rural counties currently have an exemption to this requirement?
Mr. Chair, Representative Cannon, they don't have an exemption to that, and they would merely be exempt from the additional requirements under this provision for having to go through the additional. Now, please be aware that they do continue to consult on these kinds of matters, and they work very closely together. So it's my understanding that they would not be exempt from the existing requirements, but for the additional requirements that would be placed upon them when they change a medication, when they're able to determine that there are other issues that are happening, that they not be required to send that person immediately before they can change the medications to see an ophthalmologist. Sometimes there's quite a lack of time in between the time that they could get in to see an ophthalmologist. As you can imagine, with the few ophthalmologists that there are in rural Oregon, and some of the Idaho ophthalmologists do not accept the Oregon Health Plan, with the debilitating manner that glaucoma can be, what happens is that it could be a longer wait, and so they still are in consultation with the ophthalmologist, but with the change of medications and the other requirements that the additional mandates that are brought about as a result of the request of 656, as it's A engrossed, they would be exempt from those additional requirements.
Mr. Chair, I hope that very quickly we'll get clarification on this, because this comes back to Representative Bonamici's point, and I'm totally at a loss.
I think that is one of the questions. Let's find out what there is now.
Yeah.
Well, I think let's find out what's in statute now. Let's find out what's in practice now, which I think may not be the same thing. And let's find out what this does to it. So that will be a part of our exploration.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Excellent bifurcation, Mr. Chair, of the getting to the kernel of it.
Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Well, I guess we can leave this open. Let's also open a public hearing on Senate Bill 3-4 and ask Senator Cruz and Senator Morissette to join us. Senator Morissette's already been picked on today for his natty jacket, so I'll try not to do it. I'll try not to mention it.
I think that's a nice jacket.
Yeah, well, natty is a good term.
Natty. Oh, it is a good term.
Natty. Okay. Natty's not a bad term.
Okay.
Natty Bumble.
I thought he was community or something. Yeah. Well, you never know.
No.
Using big words like natty.
Or actually medical term.
School of arts.
Senator Bill Morissette, Senate District 6, which includes parts of Lane County and Linn County. Today we're here to discuss Senate Bill 34, which came out of the Senate after quite a bit of discussion. 9 amendments were proposed. We ended up passing 3 amendments. We worked with LFO staff up until yesterday to get the fiscal, which is not a referral to Ways and Means. The objection was, are you sure you can do this on the $340,000 available? And the response was, that's all the money that is available, and they have to do it within that range. The request then was, well, why doesn't the Board of Pharmacy put a few bucks in as a backup? And so the Board of Pharmacy put in $100,000 as a backup. We're talking about, and I'll get off this funding thing for just a minute, but we're talking about a $340,000 that will be enough to fund the bill for one biennium. That's all we're talking about. What would happen after that? I know one of the objections is, well, gee, the OMA is afraid that there's going to be a very high fee levied against physicians who use the system, use the electronic tracking, because they think it's a good system. A fee would have to be approved by the legislature. If enough physicians value the program, I'm sure they will be happy to pay a modest fee. The other option is there may be some federal funding. There's a good chance that there will be an additional $400,000 grant that would follow the present grant that we're on. At some point, it may become a different type of program, funded differently, but that's in the future. We're not concerned about that today. We're concerned about getting the program started. Now, I did distribute a page with the front and back that talks somewhat about the program. There are a lot of people who are here to testify, including a woman who came from the East Coast, Dana, who is intimately familiar with the program. I did attend an NCSL one-day conference dealing with this and learned a lot about what other states are doing. And incidentally, I did kill this bill in my committee in 2005 because I was concerned about security reasons. I was concerned about law enforcement intrusion. I was concerned about the death with dignity decision that was that was to be heard by the Supreme Court a few weeks after we first heard the bill, and so I didn't have a additional hearing. The thing that kind of changed my opinion was basically the Payne Commission, which was opposed to it at that time, decided that it was actually a good thing for their physicians to be protected by having this kind of registry, so there would be no question from law enforcement that they were prescribing prescription drugs to Dr. Shopper. So this was the Payne Commission supports the bill. There's a lot to be said for this. I think that the security is in place, or the protections are in place. I think it does address an extremely serious issue concerning the number of people who are getting legal drugs illegally and end up in an emergency room oftentimes. And the pharma shopping, which is kids stealing drugs from parents or getting them illegally and putting them in the middle of a table and everybody reaches in and grabs some and so on, is a very dangerous practice that is related also to getting a hold of legal drugs and using them illegally and getting a hold of them sometimes by this doctor shopping method. So with that, I will stop and answer any questions. And
thank you. May I invite Representative Anderson to join this panel as well? Gordon, welcome. Are there any questions of Senator Morissette? Phil, thank you.
Good afternoon. Chair Greenlick, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. When Senator Morissette referred to killing the bill last session, it was my bill. And
we can join him a year ago.
Yeah, well, actually, it was co-sponsored last session by myself and Senator Gordley. And I've spent several years researching this issue, and I do want to thank Senator Morissette for the due diligence he has done over the last year and a half on the issue to familiarize himself with the repercussions. You know, what intrigued me or excited me or enticed me, however you want to put it, initially about this was the fact that we have a serious problem in this country with prescription drugs. It's, you know, we talk about illegal drugs all the time, but that's maybe just the tip of the iceberg. And we know that there are people who do drug shopping. We know that. It's a known fact. And they do it for two reasons. The first reason could be that they have an addiction and they're trying to feed their habit. The other reason is that they're selling them on the street. Neither outcome is very good. But what really intrigued me about this was not just the fact that this might be a tool that would allow us to control some illegal activities and also help some people who had addiction problems. But the other part of this was, let me back up this a little bit more, because the initial look we had at how we deal with terminal and chronic pain, Governor Kitzhaber created a task force to look into pain, and I was on that task force. And one of the things we knew at that point in time was that we had a lot of physicians that were reluctant to prescribe certain medications for people who were terminal or in chronic conditions, and you know, morphine or other drugs like that. And so we knew we had to do a culture change to try to get people in the medical community to understand that palliative care was not necessarily a bad thing, and to try to move in that direction where it was appropriate. One of the things we ran into was the fact, and this was about the time we started to see pain clinics springing up, and one of the things we ran into was the fact that a lot of prescribers were reluctant to prescribe because they had no idea what the history of the person presenting in their clinic was. And so with a program like this, it's going to be relatively easy for a physician to go online and find out what sort of drugs this person has and give them a higher level of confidence and be able to appropriately prescribe so that people are getting appropriate medications. Most people aren't playing a game. There are some that are. But how do you know when somebody presents in your office that they're a game player or somebody there for legitimate reasons. So we need to have in place a program that's going to allow us or allow the prescribers to be able to make that determination. And Mr. Chair, this is the best thing I've seen to do that. It's working in several states. We spend a lot of time making sure that the protocols and the protections were going to be appropriate in this program. And I dare say that the program we have outlined in Senate Bill 34 probably has the highest level of protection of any program in the nation, and which may at some point in time create a problem for us, because it also says that if at some point the program's up and running and we want to be able to share data with another state, which is probably also an appropriate thing out in the future, that state has to have protocols at least as good or better than ours, and at this point nobody will have protocols better than ours. So we're kind of on an island, but this may help us drive other states to update their protocols to match ours. You know, I don't really see a downside here. It's going to, you know, my ultimate goal in all this is to make sure that people have access to appropriate medication. I have a great deal of concern, a great deal of interest in people in chronic and terminal pain, and then being able to get what they need to have a quality of life. And if the fact that whoever they're seeing has no confidence in knowing what their drug mix currently is, because most of these people will have more than one prescription. And if there's no confidence in the ability to know what their mix is, a provider's going to be reluctant to prescribe what will probably be the appropriate drug, but they have to have the confidence to know that it doesn't counteract negatively with something else they're taking, or that they're not going three or four different places to get the same drug. This program will allow that to happen, and, you know, from my perspective, the fact that we are going to basically help people in very difficult situations to have as high quality of life as possible is reason enough to do this.
Thank you, Senator Cruz.
Any questions?
Thank you very much. Welcome back to the House.
Thank you, Chair Greenlee. And thank you for allowing me to testify before the committee as well. For the record, I'm former Representative Gordon Anderson. I'm retired from 37 years of dentistry, particularly the last 32 in a surgical specialty of periodontics. I hate to admit that there might be some pain involved in periodontics, but occasionally we do have a problem. And I was routinely prescribing narcotics for patients for postoperative pain. I've had my office broken into several times looking for drugs, but I've also experienced many more times having prescriptions I've written duplicated in other offices in Southern Oregon. It's really difficult to turn down a patient who's a faultless actor, and very disconcerting afterwards to find out that you're dealing with an addict who has just abused you. Last year, Senator, I took part with Senator Morissette in the NCSL seminar in San Antonio regarding drug monitoring. Senate Bill 34 is a well-written bill that deals fairly with the problem. The concept is a good one: to inform health professionals what patients are illicitly collecting scheduled narcotics and other dangerous drugs for their own abuse or the sale to others. And I think you know that one of the current fads among teenagers and younger kids is to do farming, which essentially means they're either robbing prescription drugs off their parents or grandparents, or breaking into offices, or buying them on the street and then reselling them. It's a major problem, and we need to be able to control the prescription drug parts of it much better than we do. Who could possibly condone haphazard controls of addictive drugs? Who could resist fighting the illegal use of harmful drugs? I voted with many of you last session to greatly restrict the use of ephedrine. That was an important tool in the battle or war on drugs. Another important tool in the drug war is to focus bright lights on the folks who are abusing these prescriptions. The most effective way is to compile records of those who are abusing the use of prescriptions. Law enforcement officials have records of those who commit property crimes, but doctors and pharmacists presently have no way of knowing if they are being deceived. Since the abuse of prescriptions and illegal drug use of narcotics and other dangerous drugs is one of the fastest growing sectors of abuse, arming the health professionals and pharmacists is a simple, with this simple and cost-effective tool is imperative. The federal government is offering enough money to run an effective program and will increase that money when we establish a basic program through the legislature in Bill 34. 32 other states have implemented this protection. Many of the other states are considering enacting similar bills at this time as well. We need to join them quickly to stop prescription abuse now. Because of the makeup of the proposed board, mostly professionals who are small business people, I think we're going to find that they will live closely within a budget, and there will be controls to keep costs down, and no funds should be needed from the state government. I strongly encourage you to send Bill 34 to the House floor with a due pass recommendation. I'm going to defer to Dana Droz, who really is a technical expert on a lot of the questions that you may have. She presented a wonderful program in San Antonio, and I think you'll find she's an expert in her testimony today. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, if I could add, there were issues around the budget and around the subsequent referral. Senator Morissette and I have spent a great deal of time down in LFO, and they are satisfied that this bill does not need to go to Ways and Means. The issues around the budget and the FTE, because this is in the governor's recommended budget for the Board of Pharmacy, will be dealt with in that budget package. So at this point, this is strictly a policy bill, and it's for your deliberation and your vote on the House floor.
It's not that I don't believe everything you say, but we'll check in with them too.
Okay.
Not now.
Just to verify.
Okay. Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say a word about Dana Droz, who is here again from Ohio, or is it Iowa? Ohio. Thank you. She was involved in the program in Kentucky at the very beginning of the program. She's had a lot of experience in different states, and I consider her to be an expert, a national expert in this area. So I'm pleased that she was able to come back, and thank you, Dana, for being here. Thank you.
Thanks, Senator.
Thank you all very much.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Morissette, and maybe Ms. Droz or someone else would be able to answer, but in the handout you gave us, I'm having a little difficulty distinguishing black and white. The key to the...
Well, that's on purpose.
But
I happen to have a color one.
Color one available. So I was going to ask, my question was, can you tell us how many of the states are operational drug monitoring programs, how many have enacted but not operative, legislation pending, and no program or legislation? So should we be covering that, do I understand?
Well, 30, Madam Chair, Madam...
That's the guy.
Oh, okay. Mind you, you're not the chair. Mr. Chair.
Just answer the question.
Okay, just answer the question. I don't know. The number 32 has been raised, and I know that Washington is in a state of flux, and there are various states that are, but I think 32 states is a magic number, but Dana will answer that question.
Yeah. And Ms. Chair, I apologize for the black and white copies, but the legislative budget doesn't allow us to make color. So.
We all appreciate that.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, one last question.
Yes, I'm sorry.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, it's a rare opportunity for me, being from Southern Oregon.
Okay, Gordo, go for it.
To have, in fact, not one, but two constituents testifying in the same meeting in the same day. So I appreciate Dr. Gordon Anderson, former representative from my district, and also Dr. Scott Walters in the back, who we'll hear later.
I'm sure.
But thank you for coming, and I won't give you a hard time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for hearing us.
Thank you all very much.
Right. I'm going to close. Well, we have two hearings going at the same time, so we can keep that up. But why don't I close the hearing right now on SB 34, and we are still have open a hearing on SB 656. We expect Senator Courtney to join us momentarily, and when he does, we'll ask him to talk to us. I would like, if I can, a representative of the proponents of this bill, which is the this bill was introduced on behalf of the American Academy, the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. Could I have somebody from that group talk to me? And could I have somebody that sounds like an official representative of optometry talk to me? So we can get to some questions. Which people? Oh, yes. Dr. Walters, will you join us? And whoever, no, whoever from optometry. Both of you. Yeah, we'll be doing that as a part of the process. But what? Is she on the phone? Well, what I'd sort of like to have is a sense of, as I said before, what's the situation now? What's the statute now? And what's this bill trying to do to change that? And then we can, if we get a sense of that, we can start talking about better questions about what we ought to be talking about.
Chairman Greenlich, I'm, for the record, Dr. Scott Walters from Grants Pass, Oregon, current chairman of the Oregon Board of Optometry. Current statute is such that initial consultation is necessary when an optometrist sees a patient who is being diagnosed with glaucoma. And so practice in the state with that consultation is that before we initiate treatment, we consult with the primary care doctor for that patient, primary care physician or primary care provider, and usually also with an ophthalmologist prior to starting treatment. That's common practice.
And then again, or not again, or as needed, PRN?
Speaking from my own personal practice, when I see that patient, and glaucoma patients get seen regularly, ongoing checks usually every 3 to 6 months, and so usually I will send a report to the primary doctor subsequently, at least annually. And that's, I feel, common practice among optometrists as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the House Health Committee, my name is Bob Tybalt. I'm an ophthalmologist here in Salem and legislative chair for the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology. I think it should be noted that our interest in formulating and having introduced Senate Bill 656 began with Organized Optometry's Senate Bill 35, which proposed to delete this initial consultation with an ophthalmologist or any other physician at the time where glaucoma therapy might be initiated. So that's where our interest in addressing this question began. So I think the language states ophthalmologist or any other physician. So it's not an eye-directed consultation. It's a consultation directed at possibly with an ophthalmologist if the optometrist elected to do that, or possibly with a primary care physician just to let that practitioner know that, hey, I'm starting your patient on an eye drop. So that's the language of the law as it exists, and that's the origin of our interest in pursuing what we are pursuing in Senate Bill 656. So I think that comments upon the practice, because their Senate Bill 35 proposed to delete that requirement.
And where is that requirement statute right now?
I'm not an expert on answering that question, but I believe it's in the Optometric Practice Act.
That is correct, and I don't have the exact number, but that is correct.
It's on the back of the... Mr. Chair, I believe that's the potentially deleted language on your question, page 2, line 33.
33 and 34. Yeah, so the notion is this bill would delete that language, which is on line 33 on page 2?
Correct.
And add this language to it?
Correct. So, in fact, we concurred with the intent of Senate Bill 35 that they introduced, that was not an optimal time to consult with an ophthalmologist at the initiation of glaucoma therapy. And, frankly, it caused us to think, well, all right, if that's not a good time, when is a good time? And so that's the intent of this law, this bill, that at a point where people are at risk for losing vision, that would be an ideal time to consult with an ophthalmologist, not refer a patient to an ophthalmologist, consult so that care could be optimized and the chance of losing vision could be minimized.
And our position on that, our being the Oregon Board of Optometry and the Oregon Optometric Physicians Association, is that these types of practice protocols really don't belong in statute. We have clinical practice guidelines. This is an outdated version because now they're all on the web. Science-based medicine changes constantly. There's been 4 to 5 major studies out of the NEI that have totally given us more information about treating glaucoma over the past 10 years. If you put practice protocols into statute, it doesn't allow for science and technology, which is going to change. Every time there's a change in that type of care, that type of information, we're going to be back in front of you, clogging the system, because that's not where practice protocols belong. They belong in practice guidelines and preferred practice patterns that are out there. They're published. They're updated regularly. They don't belong in statute.
All right. Now, are there questions?
Can I make one more statement, please?
Sure.
I'd also like to, just from the Board of Optometry's perspective, in the past 10 years, we have looked at 779 complaints that have come before us. When we look at a complaint, whether it's the doctor didn't do my glasses right, I dispute this fee, whatever it is, we request records. When we look at records, we look at everything. Okay? We look at if there's maybe a misdiagnosis or a bad treatment, whether it be refractive or medical. And in those 779 cases in the last 10 years, there's not been one case where we found a misdiagnosis of glaucoma or bad treatment of glaucoma. And it's the Oregon Board of Optometry's charge to protect the public, and we think we do a fine job with that. We have received no communication, no complaints from citizens of Oregon, from other ophthalmologists, from other primary care practitioners, from any insurance company saying that there's a malpractice claim against an optometrist. Zero.
Senator Maher?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I have several questions. One is, where else in the statute do we put practice protocols or standards of care? And I'm trying to think of where else in the statute we've done that. We've done it. I don't know of any place.
I expect we have. But.
Okay. And then... So, how many glaucoma patients are seen each year in Oregon? That's for either. Is it?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I certainly don't have the answer to that in specific numbers, but it's thousands.
Yeah, it's pretty common.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how many problems, you answered the question, how many problems you've had, but from
the board seeing zero, yes.
From the academy, how many complaints have there been?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I wish I could say I didn't have any problems in the management of glaucoma, but I don't regard that as possible. Glaucoma is a very difficult disease to manage. It is a potentially blinding disease. in the best of hands, glaucoma still blinds people. There are certain varieties of glaucoma that defy conventional criteria and make it very difficult to diagnose and treat. So it's a matter of degree, but there's a spectrum of people who are either at risk for glaucoma. And just to say a few words about what glaucoma is an eye disease in which the optic nerve, the main cable between the eye and the brain, is damaged such that vision is lost. We're all endowed with 1.5 million nerve fibers in each optic nerve. When we lose a sufficient number of those, it begins to affect the vision. We lose vision. When that vision is lost, it's gone for good. The only way we have to treat glaucoma is by lowering the pressure in the eye. There are different ways to do that. One can do it with eye drops, with laser, with open surgery, or with oral medications. The premise behind this bill, the rationale, is that only ophthalmologists have the full armamentarium to treat glaucoma at all junctures. And so at a juncture in which the patient is at risk for losing vision, we just ask for a referral, a consultation, discuss the patient. I did it last week with an optometrist with whom I regularly work. He forwarded me the data that he generated. I did not threaten the relationship that he had with his patient. I reviewed the data. I contacted him back. And it helped the patient's care because it helped to refine the goals of treatment. And the optometrist was appreciative. All we're asking is that that become the standard of care in Oregon.
My question was, how many, and I'm the issue is not that glaucoma causes blindness, but the issue is, how many complaints have you received about optometrists at the academy?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, we all make mistakes. You don't have to be an ophthalmologist or an optometrist to make a mistake. I see mistakes in practice. We ran an informal poll of our membership a few weeks ago when SB 656 was on the Senate side. We had numerous reports from our members about problems with optometric management of glaucoma. Now, that doesn't mean that optometry is bad. That doesn't mean that the care that they deliver is bad. It merely means that nothing in this world is perfect, and that the care that they were given resulted in a problem. So, yes, I have seen problems.
Okay. Maybe I need to rephrase my question. The question is, how many complaints have you received regarding glaucoma care from optometrists that, because I'm assuming you would refer that question to the Board of Optometry, just like, you know, the Board of Nursing refers questions about physicians to the BME. So the question is not about a survey, but about complaints from patients about the care they receive from optometrists.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Maurer, I have not received complaints from patients per se. That's not how it goes. In medicine, you see a patient, you evaluate the patient, you make a diagnosis, and then you advise the patient on what is best for his or her care. The worst thing you can do for a patient is to put him or her between two different practitioners and say, Dr. X has been doing this, that's wrong. I want you to do this. That is not conducive to that patient's well-being. It's not conducive to the patient's care. So while if I identify a problem, I would say something like, this is what I think today. I was not there earlier when you received your care from Dr. X, but this is what I think you need now, and this is what I think we should do. And that's what you do when you care about the welfare of the patient. You don't say, Mrs. Jones, I really think the care that you've been receiving is poor, and I'm going to turn that doctor into the Board of Optometry.
Again, that wasn't the question, because in our practice, that's not how we operate either. But the issue is that
Representative, I think you may have gotten as much of an answer as you're going to get from this witness.
Okay.
Representative Kotek? Representative Richardson? Representative Flores?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question on page 2 of the bill. It's the lines 33 and 34, the lines in question that are potentially going to be deleted. I'm sensing there was some discomfort from the Academy around the consult as current practice. It could be an ophthalmologist. It could be a doctor of medicine or a doctor of osteopathy. Do you have concerns about other doctors? Because that's the current practice. Instead of doing all of this, why not just say, ophthalmologist, period, if that's the issue versus a whole new set of protocols? I guess I'm trying to figure out the problems with the existing statute. Is it something to do with other consults outside of ophthalmologists? Or?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kotek, requirement for consultation would have been a meaningful, useful descriptor of good care, it would not have said with an ophthalmologist or other physician, because no other physician can comment on the management of glaucoma, because a general practitioner doesn't have the knowledge to manage glaucoma, diagnose, treat it, or advise upon it. So that language there does not achieve the goal of fortifying the management of glaucoma. As to why we didn't just delete the rest of the language and say must consult with an ophthalmologist at the time of diagnosis and initiation of treatment of glaucoma, I think that would be a fair thing to do. But if you want to get the most bang for the buck, the time to do it is when, you know, optometrists are valuable members of the eye care team. And if they have diagnosed a patient either with glaucoma or at risk for glaucoma, that's a higher yield. And when they cannot manage that to the point of being stable, that's when you're running the risk of losing vision. And that's the intent, to identify patients at risk for losing vision, not just who have the diagnosis of glaucoma or preglaucoma or elevated eye pressure, but rather people who are at imminent risk of losing vision. Those are the ones we want to hear about, the ones we want to advise optometrists about, so that we can prevent loss of vision.
Chairman Greenlee,
can you, Doctor, can I have a follow-up with that?
Sure.
Actually, to you. So in your practice, is it only at the beginning when you're instituting treatment, or are you having ongoing consultation with either the ophthalmologist or the doctor? I'm just wondering.
In my practice, I do both. The key question, again, is where do these protocols belong? And in our opinion, it's not in statute, because they change. And
that's not the question. You're
correct. Yes, I'm sorry. But yeah, so in my practice, I work very closely with ophthalmologists in Grants Pass and Medford. We only have one glaucoma specialist in all of Southern Oregon, who's fellowship trained in glaucoma. But the other ophthalmologists obviously are trained in some of the surgical procedures, and I consult with them numerous times a year on when patients get to a point. So, again, we do that as standard practice. And so,
thank you. I just was trying to get a sense of the continuum. It's not just a one-time
thing.
Thank you.
Representative Richardson?
Thank you. I think that Representative Kotek and Representative Cannon have kind of focused on what's really the issue here. If we look at what's going in, we have Section 2 and Section 3, which are simply the same as wording that's coming out. So those are the same. So now we're looking at one line that comes out. It says, prior to instituting treatment with anti-glaucoma medication, optometrists shall consult with an ophthalmologist or other doctor of medicine or doctor of osteopathy. Now it's going to say an optometrist treating a patient with anti-glaucoma medication shall consult with an ophthalmologist. So basically, the change is that other doctors of medicine or osteopathy are not competent to do what an ophthalmologist can do. Otherwise, we wouldn't be changing that. We're restricting who can actually be consulted with. And so now the question is, is this a turf issue? Because ophthalmologists...
You're also changing the time.
In the time.
On the other side, you have to do it before you start. On this side, you only have to do it after the advanced treatment.
That's true. And actually, advanced, when there is imminent risk of losing vision. So that's a change. And so do you have evidence to indicate that there are a substantial number of Oregon patients who are being mistreated, maltreated, or non-treated by other doctors, the ones that we're now deleting, and that would still have better treatment or have their vision had they come to an ophthalmologist? Not hearsay. I mean, is this a solution searching for a problem, or is there really a problem that this solution is needed to solve?
Mr. Chairman, Vice Chairman Richardson, the only practitioners who are competent to manage glaucoma are either optometrists or ophthalmologists. So the question about whether non-ophthalmologist medical doctors can advise on glaucoma, the answer to that is no. So there's no, this section is, its deletion is being contemplated. And the reason is because no one other than an ophthalmologist could help an optometrist to manage glaucoma. No other physician other than an ophthalmologist.
Just to follow up, you're stating that as a fact. But if somebody didn't believe it, I mean, show us, is there evidence to support that in Oregon that patients have not come to an ophthalmologist, that have just worked with an optometrist and another physician, have lost the vision or have been damaged? Do you have any data to support what you're saying other than the statement itself?
No.
Thank you.
Senator Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I might. And is it Dr. Timolt?
Tybalt. Yes.
Thank you, and I apologize. I understand that the focus of this bill is the term consult, so a consultation, although when you were presenting, you used the term referral. And I don't see those as interchangeable. So we're not talking about Dr. Walters referring his patient to you so that you can see his patient, are we? Are we talking about Dr. Walters picking up the phone call and talking with you about the patient's symptomologies and medications and so on?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I misspoke when I used the word refer when I was describing this bill. The goal, the intent of the bill is to mandate consultation, which is a term that describes when one physician communicates with another about a patient.
Thank you for the clarification.
Yes.
Dr. Walters, I'm going to ask this one of you because the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology document here does seem to put an emphasis on only ophthalmologists can provide surgical treatments for glaucoma. So obviously when a patient has reached the stage requiring surgery, ophthalmologists are the ones who are in their scope of practice the ones to be doing that. Do optometrists ever proceed to or try to do the surgical procedures, or is that totally outside your scope of practice?
Totally outside of our scope of practice.
Thank you. And I do have a couple of other questions, but we'll move along.
Well, go on.
Well, I was just...
Let me say where we are. What I'd like to do is end this hearing. We have a couple of people on the phone to talk to, maybe 25 after 4, and we'll go into the other hearing where we have a lot of people. I'm at least be willing, and any of the others be willing to stay till about 5:30. So if you all go off with other, I know you have prior commitments, we'll keep hearing it. So let's go with your
question. Would be very quick, and I guess just to draw the picture a little bit for the information about data collection on complaints. It's like, you know, if I have a complaint with a contractor, I might call the Better Business Bureau. Would the Oregon Academy of Ophthalmology be the repository for someone who would have a complaint or be collecting data for complaints in this field for mistreatment of glaucoma patients?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, no. I have no relationship with the Board of Optometry. no special representation there. I'm just an ordinary citizen with regards to the Board of Optometry. I have no obligation to consult with the Board of Optometry about any of its members. And if I had a complaint about an optometrist, I wouldn't, you know, I would just be reporting it like any other citizen would to the Board of Optometry. But I have no relationship with the Board of Optometry.
And I, if I might, just very quickly, no, I wasn't presuming that you would, but I mean, as a data resource, to see if we can find if there is actually something to substantiate the fact that there is a problem in this area.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, when there are problems in the management of glaucoma, they end up with an ophthalmologist. Because when the pressure gets too high, or there's loss of vision, or there's a complication, the pathway always leads to an ophthalmologist. So, in fact, that would, our sphere of practice would be a repository for the cases that are problem cases, but there's no mechanism to use that accumulation of cases as a data set to report back to the Board of Optometry.
Okay, and I understand that the ultimate repository for the patient would be an ophthalmologist, but there must be some brand record keeping data repository.
I think it's the Board of Optometry that would get the complaints about optometrists, isn't that right?
Chair Greenlick and the Board of Optometry would receive complaints regarding optometrists, and occasionally we actually get complaints for ophthalmologists. In fact, we just had a board meeting today, and we had a complaint that was sent to us, and we sent it directly over to the BME without even looking at it. And I think the BME is charged to do the same thing. If they get a complaint about an optometrist, it goes to the Board of Optometry. So if there was any public complaints regarding any medical doctor in the state of Oregon, whatever their specialty is, I'm fairly certain it would go to the BME.
Oh, thank you. Just trying to unpack where that might be. Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kotek first, and then...
Thank you.
Representative Bonamici. You're down there further away. I don't see you.
You want me to go first? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Miguel's are also. No,
I just have...
I can't even read my notes here. That's
I just have a quick comment, and it's more of a request both to the optometric physicians and the ophthalmology, the academy is. Mm-hmm. And this, I don't think that the concern raised by Senator Carter is necessarily addressed by this bill, which is the untreated predominance of glaucoma in the African-American community. So I would like to hear back from your associations about what you do to address that particular issue. We don't have to talk about it now, but if you could get me that information, I'd appreciate it.
You can do that.
I guess it's Representative Gelser first. I see you way up on the list. I've been ignoring you for a while.
Well, other people have asked this question in different ways, and I haven't heard the answer yet, so I'll just take a stab at it my way. In the origin of this bill, and I understand the concerns that Representative Kotek just raised, where is the demonstrated evidence of patients who have been harmed because the practice is currently the way that it is? What has driven you? What problem, which patients, and how many of them have driven this bill to be drafted to correct individuals with glaucoma who have been harmed by using the current practices in law?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, the evidence is anecdotal. It is not a database that has been assembled and analyzed and served as a source of impetus for this bill. It is a sense about the treatment of glaucoma being very tricky and very difficult to diagnose and treat, and at a certain point, the risk for vision loss is what's driving this. It's the risk. The way all medical conditions are managed these days, including glaucoma, is risk stratification, to analyze the risk and then make sure you're doing the appropriate treatment to manage the high-risk patient. That's what driving this is driving this. There is no body of data.
So just a quick follow-up, Mr. Chair, is that okay?
Please go ahead, yeah.
So there's not a case of a specific patient or patients that have been harmed or lost their vision that has caused this bill to be drafted. It's more based on a general concern that glaucoma is a difficult thing to manage, but it's not based on something that's actually happened to someone.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gelser, cases happen. with some frequency. As I say, when there are problem cases that have been managed by optometrists, they always end up with ophthalmologists. We see the problem cases.
And there are problem cases.
And there are problem cases. And there are not just a few problems.
But there are problem cases in ophthalmology.
Of course, there are. But it's the ability to manage the high risk problem cases that is the difference. There are cases. There may be no complaints at the Board of Optometry level, but there are not a small number of cases at the ophthalmology level. It's a fact.
But let me make sure we get this straight on the record. As you pointed out, the treatment of glaucoma can be a very tricky thing, whether by an optometrist or an ophthalmologist. And there are cases that turn into problems that are handled by ophthalmologists, and I would suspect if we talk to BME, we find some complaints against ophthalmologists in the treatment of glaucoma as well. But it is a complicated issue to treat.
Thank you. That helps.
It's your turn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll preface my question by reminding the pharmacists in the room that this is a citizen legislature. And lines 13 and 14, there's two different comments, two different phrases. One of them is a single glaucoma
medication. Was that pharmacist remark aimed at me?
No, it's... one of the phrases is a single glaucoma medication, and the other line is more than one medication. So, say, for example, take these eye drops in the morning and use these eye drops in the evening. Is that a single medication? And what if you had two different compounds in one prescription? Is that more than one medication?
Mr. Chair, Senator Bonamici.
Don't demote her.
No.
Representative. Thank you. Pardon me. A single medication is just that. It might be used four times a day, but it's a single medication. The question about a combination medicine is relevant because there happens to be a glaucoma medicine that includes two different, a glaucoma brand that includes two different medicines in one bottle. It's a combination medicine. So that would actually be two medicines. The difference in between A and B under 3 is that the glaucoma progresses despite the use of a single glaucoma medication, or more than one medication is required to control the glaucoma. So if one were required to use two medicines and achieve control, that would be criteria for consultation. Or if there was progression of the image of the optic nerve that we can measure, or the visual fields that we measure, documenting progression of the glaucoma, then that would be a criteria for consultation.
Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. So, and I'd also like to hear from Dr. Walters about this. So if the compound prescription was what was advisable, would this be triggered that the optometrist would then have to consult with the ophthalmologist?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes.
Thank you. Is that your understanding too, Dr.?
Yes.
Thank you.
President Korczak has a quick question, then I want to end this panel. We've got some folks waiting on the phone.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just briefly, if you use the word progresses in line 13, I think that would have to be defined if we're going to put something like this in statute. So I'm assuming that would take longer to discuss, but that's a pretty loaded term.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kotek, it is actually a specific event based upon imaging, where we use imaging techniques to either photograph the optic nerve or use computerized analysis of the optic nerve and look for identifiable changes in the appearance of the optic nerve and its structure, or we look in changes of a visual field test which measures the function of the optic nerve. And so these are the two specific features of progression.
Thank you. I think I'm going to thank you both.
That is discussed in B below.
So that would be your definition. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Greenlick and committee, I would just like to thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
In consideration. Can I? We have numerous optometrists here. I just wanted to recognize, even in the overflow room, and if they could just stand, we're just wanting to show our commitment to our patients. And so
I'm going to ask you a few more yet to testify that I'm signed up. Can we get the, there are two folks on the phone, or? Can you? They've been waiting for a long time on the phone. Let's see if we get whoever that is. And thank you both very much. Hello? Hello?
Hello?
Hi, would you identify yourself? You're...
Yes, this is Cheryl Blankenship from Baker City.
You're on the air. And you have some testimony for us?
Yes, yes.
Go for it.
So, well, I just want to thank you for your attention on this very important matter. I've been in practice for over 20 years here in Baker City, and my partner, Dr. Leslie Ounce, has been here for more than 10. And together, we do provide eye care to the majority of the people of Baker County. Particular interest with regards to this bill, of course, in the care of glaucoma, is to know that why we feel so passionately against this bill. You must understand that we treat hundreds of patients with glaucoma and truly believe we do an absolutely awesome job. If this bill passed, we would have patients who would not get the care they need in a timely fashion because we would have to consult before providing necessary treatment. Here in Baker City, that could mean a 1 to 2 hour trip to another city. And most of these patients with glaucoma are elderly, on a fixed income. Many have limited transportation abilities, which, you know, this is an unnecessary expense for the patient when we know what we were doing. I just really would advise you not to pass this bill. It will jeopardize patient care. There's nothing more devastating to our profession than potentially being a part of someone losing their vision because we can't provide the care that is needed in a timely fashion. We know how to treat glaucoma. We have the education. We have the necessary equipment and the expertise to take care of our patients. There's absolutely no basis for this bill. There has not been one complaint or case of malpractice regarding our treatment of glaucoma. And this bill truly will jeopardize patient care and increase their costs.
Dr. Blankenship, this talks about consulting. Can you consult other than having somebody drive to Bend?
We have a local ophthalmologist, which we actually have a good working relationship with, but he does not specialize in glaucoma, and, you know, he is not available at all times. So often, in consultation, we are going all the way to Boise, Idaho. Otherwise, we go up to Tri-Cities. I mean, those are our two places that we often have to send people for consultation. So we have truly invested in, you know, high-tech equipment so that we can take care of those patients effectively here.
Are there other questions for Dr. Blankenship?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hi, Doctor. I'm Scott Bruin. Just a quick question. In your scope of practice, how often, on a percentage basis, if you will, with the glaucoma patients you treat, do you need to send them out for further referral?
I would say not that often, because typically glaucoma is manageable with drops. When we need further, you know, if the drops are not working or the patient is not responding to the drops, or we have, you know, exhausted the drops available for that patient, because you can't use all drops on every patient because of, you know, potential side effects depending on their systemic conditions, then we will send if there is need for a surgical consult, certainly. You're asking what percentage? I would say less than 5%.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Quickly?
Yes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dr. Blankenship, this is Linda Flores. In your normal practice, do you consult with an ophthalmologist before you currently begin treatment for glaucoma?
We have a protocol set that it is not always an ophthalmologist. Often it is a medical practitioner. And often the reason, I mean, we are consulting because we need to. That is part of our law. But we consult with the medical practitioner in particular to let them know what the patient, what drops we want to put the patient on, so that they are aware of their systemic condition. If they can let us know that we shouldn't use a particular drop because of a heart condition or lung condition. So it is not always an ophthalmologist, no.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I follow up with another question?
Please.
Dr. Blankenship, you may have, Scott Bruin again, you may have mentioned this. How many years have you been in practice in Baker City?
Over 20 years.
Okay, so you've been in the profession a long time.
Yes.
Since you started, once again, getting back to the referrals that have to go out to the ophthalmologist, have you seen a decrease within your practice of the a decrease in the frequency of which you have to do that you could attribute to the improvement in glaucoma treatment? Or has it been consistent for 20 years?
Oh, definitely. Are you saying, do I have to refer less out now?
Correct.
Yes, and part of that reason is because of the diagnostic equipment available now to give us the information we need to properly manage these patients. You know, 20 years ago, we didn't have the instrumentation to measure certain things, such as how thick is the nerve fiber layer. We now know that if that nerve fiber layer is thinning, then that means that glaucoma is advancing. Well, 20 years ago, we didn't have the ability to measure that. Now we do, and of course, we have that equipment available to us, so we can monitor that, and, you know, we can definitely catch glaucoma quicker, and we're treating it more effectively.
So, Doctor, one last follow-up. You sort of ventured a guess that you were referring out 5% now. What was it 20 years ago? Was it double that, triple that?
Probably triple that.
Okay, thank you.
Triple that only because, well, we didn't have the instrumentation, so, you know, you were more apt to get a consultation if you didn't, because you didn't know for sure. Now, I mean, we feel very confident in our treatment abilities. I can't stress that enough, in our ability to diagnose and treat.
Thank you.
Okay.
Dr. Blankenship, this is Dennis Richardson. You mentioned that that you will make contact with a treating physician to discuss medications, heart conditions, other things that could affect the prescription of medication. If you were required to make contact with an ophthalmologist, would you also still make contact with the treating physicians for those same purposes that you had expressed earlier?
Definitely. We actually have a form letter that we just have to fill in the appropriate spot. So it's very easy, so it's not going to be something we don't do because of not having time. That is very important, whether it's glaucoma or diabetes. We correspond with all of the physicians regarding our patients that have glaucoma, diabetes. Okay? That's crucial. So, yes, we would continue consulting, or at least, I don't know if you would call it so much consulting at that time, would be informing them and asking them to get back to us if there was any reason we should not put the patient on that medication.
Dr. Blankenship, let me ask you if you'd like to hang on to the phone. Let me call two more witnesses. We have about five more minutes. Can I have Wayne Shoemaker and Frank Story?
Yeah.
If you'd like to make brief comments, and we'll try and be done in a very few minutes.
If you obviously don't know Dr. Story, brief is not in his...
Good afternoon. I want to make a couple comments on it.
Introduce yourself.
I'm sorry. I'm Dr. Frank Story. I'm an optometric physician. Glaucoma is a very complicated disease. I was at a glaucoma conference a couple years ago, and the glaucoma specialist said, you know, we need to tell all patients from the get-go that very seldom in the course of the disease is the disease controlled with just one eye drop. He said almost all patients over the course of time are going to require more than one drop. Now, what this bill would do, consequently, is that is going to require almost all optometric patients to be seen by an ophthalmologist. Now, I've been treating glaucoma for over 15 years.
Actually, it only requires you to consult with an ophthalmologist.
Well, that's true, but the ophthalmologist has the right to say, I want to see the patient. So when you consult, the ophthalmologist says, yeah, I think I better have a look at him. So it's both sides of the issue. The thing of it is, with glaucoma, when I first started treating glaucoma, I'd have a patient that I felt couldn't get adequately controlled.
I would send them to a general ophthalmologist. The general ophthalmologist would always send them to a glaucoma specialist. It didn't take me long to figure out to send my patients directly to a glaucoma specialist. You know, glaucoma specialists, that's all they do. Now, we're talking about protocols, and we need to refer patients to ophthalmologists. We need to refer patients to glaucoma specialists. Now, my question to the Academy of Ophthalmology is that they're concerned about this progressive disease. Are they going to have protocols for general ophthalmologists when they send to a glaucoma specialist? We haven't discussed that. So,
and we're not going to discuss it.
Why not?
Talk about?
Why not?
Because it's not in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Why isn't it?
But my question. Thank you very much for your testimony. Okay. Wayne, do you want to testify?
Yes, hopefully I can wrap this up for you, Kerr Greenlake. For the record, my name is Wayne Schumacher. I'm the executive director of the Optometric Physicians Association, and I'm afraid I'm probably one of the people that started this in the first place, because on the second page, the language that's being taken out about the initial consult was what we had initiated in Senate Bill 35 in the Senate. That then was incorporated into 656 when they felt that it was indeed there was merit to it, but that they wanted to add additional. What 656 does is establish specific protocols in statute, which we believe is a precedence. There are protocols in statute, but typically, to answer your question, is that those would be time protocols, for an example, in workers' comp, where a chiropractic visits a subject to maybe 10 in a 30-day period, et cetera, that sort of thing. The example that we were taking out or asking to be taken out is the other example of a protocol. That's a protocol as opposed to a scope of practice issue. A scope issue would say you can treat glaucoma, you can't. You can treat the ankle and the foot or just the foot. That's a scope issue. What we're doing here is arbitrarily, without any evidence, asking the legislature to put specific scope of specific protocols in statute. We were sensitive to the fact that maybe there are issues. And we actually went to the Academy and proposed a mechanism whereby we could get this straightened out. They refused us to consider it. So we have no other option but to simply oppose this bill, even though our initial language is contained in it. We would ask you to not support this bill at all. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions?
Just a quick one.
A quick one.
Quick one. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What kind of doctors are glaucoma specialists?
They have a residency in ophthalmology. They also have an additional residency in glaucoma. They limit their practice to glaucoma.
Thank you.
Dr. Blankenship, are you going?
No, I can't.
Okay, still here. Good. All right. Thank you very much. Let me note for the record, we have written testimony from Carol Timpone.
Timpone,
sorry.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that was attached to my testimony, right. And Carol Timpone is from the College of Optometry, and that's specific to the education.
Great.
Also, you were passed out three letters from ophthalmologists around the state who also oppose this, and they asked me to present that.
I'm reading that into the record. Daryl Gensler.
Gensler.
Gensler. Bruce Madsen, there's one I can pronounce. And Scott Cherney. That's great. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Blankenship. I'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 656, and we'll reopen the Senate bill on the public hearing on Senate Bill 34. I'd like to start with the first panel of Paige Clark, Dana Dross, and Andrea Meyer, a couple of proponents and one opponent. And panel two will have Blake Rice, Robert Pearson, I think it is, and Shelda Holmes, folks from far away and other things. So if we can start with, hi. Wait a minute, let the dust clear. Oh, absolutely. No, I think we want to do it while we have a... While we're waiting, let me close the public hearing for a moment on Senate Bill 34 and open a public hearing, open a work session. Well, I don't need to open a work session, I found out.
Okay.
I'll take a motion to suspend the rules to allow Representative Bruin to change his vote on House Bill 2801.
Can I make the motion?
You can make that motion. Anybody can make that motion.
I would ask for the committee's consent to reopen House Bill 2801 to allow me to change my vote from yes to no.
Is there any objection to that? None heard? How do you vote?
No.
Do you have the recorder there? Representative Bruin, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate it.
Reopen a public hearing on Senate Bill 34. Why don't we start with the proponents, and then we'll hear from
certainly
Fire, and then we'll hear from some other people.
Thank you, Representative Greenlick.
And as you guys need to be leaving, I hope you can stay as long as you can, but I understand when you need to go.
Oh, but this will be great fun. None of you will want to go anywhere, I'm sure.
You're like hiding this honey first.
Indeed.
That's
exactly right. I am Paige Clark. I'm the staff consultant pharmacist with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. I've met with many of you on several pharmacy bills, including this one, on a couple of occasions. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members. As the staff pharmacist consultant with the Oregon Board of Pharmacy, I come to the table today in support of Senate Bill 34 and to bring you several experts and individuals with valuable input and background. Most importantly, I'm going to cut to the chase here. We've brought you a packet of information that many of you have not seen yet. And as you look through that, I'd like to point out a couple of interesting things that respond to fiscal questions, security questions, etc. And so I'll do that very, very briefly. I've cut my testimony quite a lot, and then we will move on to Ms. Dana Droz, who has come here from Ohio. She is a lawyer, and she is a pharmacist, and she is the leading expert in this entire nation on the issue of prescription drug monitoring programs, and is really quite an expert and able to answer your questions. This is a very simple piece of legislation that directs the Board of Pharmacy to establish and maintain a database for an electronically housed comprehensive prescription record. That is really what we are talking about here. It is for use by practitioners and pharmacists in Oregon. Let me give you an example. When you go to a pharmacy to have a prescription filled today, there are silos, if you think of them that way, of prescription information out there. You have your prescription filled at a Safeway pharmacy, and there is a silo of information that is in that Safeway computer system. There's another silo if you go to a Rite Aid pharmacy, for example, and all that information would be in that silo of computer information. Thirdly, if you are, for example, a Blue Cross Blue Shield patient, there would be an additional silo of information about your prescription filling issues there. They don't talk to each other. That's evident to all of us. This prescription creates an overall comprehensive prescription record for these practitioners to refer to when making prescribing decisions. In the world that we live in today, the word database is an unfortunate term because all of us have great concerns over that term. I want to be certain that this committee understands what this is. It creates unified prescription information compiled of prescription records, nothing more, nothing less. It is simply a comprehensive prescription chart, in essence, that we are creating. There is no information, personal or otherwise, that is included in this system that is not on a prescription blank when you have a prescription filled today. So, no Social Security number, which was also put in the bill, no driver's license, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There has never been a breach of any of the existing programs. Senate Bill 34 also includes a civil penalty for potential misuse. There is no access to this information available to anyone who doesn't have access to it today. In fact, in response to a concern raised by the ACLU stakeholders some time back, the access by law enforcement to this record has been further limited than it is at the pharmacy level to that requiring a court order. These systems have a credentialing component for the prescribers to ensure that that person is who they say they are when they gain access to the system. And there is a report tracking mechanism to assist in carefully maintaining the integrity of the system along with the latest encryption and software security components. Currently, there is no system in Oregon that is accurate, comprehensive, and HIPAA compliant with which this would be to provide prescribers and pharmacists with accurate and cumulative prescription information. So some of of you have asked me how we dealt with this in the past. I've talked to you a number of times about the fact that years ago, I've been a pharmacist for 21 years, we used to sort of fax around information to each other in a way to attempt to stay on top of this sort of information. That is not HIPAA compliant. That is not how we do this now. We have absolutely no system that we are left to deal with unless we put this into place. Briefly, to address the issue of accuracy, the only way that something could be inaccurately entered into this system is if it were inaccurately filled at the pharmacy level by the pharmacist. And that, of course, is a breach of the Pharmacy Practice Act and would be dealt with by the Board of Pharmacy. If there is something incorrectly filled for a patient at the pharmacy level, it will be corrected at the pharmacy level, and that correction will then be entered into the database. There is no manipulation of data that will happen at the board level where this will be run. This is simply a reflection of what is happening in all of the various silos of information out there with prescription data in them. Finally, a word to the fiscal questions raised and addressed of late. In the recently amended fiscal, there's reference to our federal funding and the fact that we've been awarded a $350,000 federal grant, and the likelihood of an additional $400,000 maximum grant is referenced in a letter from DOJ that's included in your packet, of the pink packet on the last page, which puts us probably at about $750,000 to work with just initially to get the program up and running. Arguments that we somehow do not have adequate funding are misleading. Let me also refer you to the document that illustrates the annual operating budgets of a number of states. If you look at the green packet on the last page, you will see they range in annual from $47,000 to $1.7 million. There's quite a range there. The often referred to Washington state plan could be considered to be perhaps somewhat inflated, considering they claim to intend to support 10 FTEs and develop a completely in-house program. We, on the other hand, do not intend to reinvent the wheel, but rather to mirror the many states that have begun programs more modestly and have grown them over time. Over 30 states are successfully implementing, augmenting, and running such programs on a variety of budgets. It is absolutely correct. There has not been determined a source of long-term permanent funding for this program. It's my understanding that many programs are started with no permanent, irrevocable long-term funding in this state. Will we completely run on federal grants? Some states do. Some states charge their licensees, all prescribers and pharmacists, a moderate annual fee to help maintain their programs. Some use general funds. See the handout at the green outlining how the states finance their programs. There's a two-page sheet in there. It'll run you through a number of states. I believe it starts with the state of Idaho, and it tells you exactly how they do long-term funding for every state. Clearly, that's a question for our entire state to have discussion on 2 years from now, once we have the program up and running. You will also see that it briefly addresses the possible fee schedule of numbers that we have crunched that illustrates a minimal annual fee netting over $1 million biennial program. And that is held at about a $20 a year annual fee for all prescribers and pharmacists in the state of Oregon. I would like you to be able to be very comfortable taking a look at that number, please. Until we get the program instituted and running, it is probably not appropriate to put in the statute how we will finance it, partly because there is a permanent commission that is put in place statutorily that will help to drive the decision-making that must go into the program. Also determining at this time who should or should not be included in the support of the program via amendment seems perhaps a bit premature. Which bells and whistles, what features are we going to need in the state of Oregon to run this program will be determined by this group. What components are most important to the prescribers and pharmacists of our state? Until we have this program fully running, we may not know. We may want to add additional bells and whistles. These are the questions that will help us determine the long-range funding needed for this program. We've taken the advice of many other states who have such programs in place, and they all have advised us to get the program instituted and continually evaluate the improvements and augmentations that can be made. The legislators who put forth this bill intended that we do exactly that. I hope that the information in the packets helped to address many of the questions voiced. I'm sure that there will be many questions, but in deference to our time today, I would like to introduce Dana Droz, who has come from Ohio and can speak to the concept of prescription drug monitoring and how it is done throughout our nation.
Mr. Droz, how long do you think your presentation will take?
As quickly as possible.
What's your estimate on?
10 minutes or less. Chairman Greenlick, members of the committee, thank you very much.
We've got a witness who needs to leave soon, so perhaps we'll get him in before Ms. Meyer, we'll see you. Okay. Please go ahead.
I'm going to go very quickly, hit just the high points, and then I'll be open for questions. Several things that I think you need to understand. There are only basically three categories of drugs: those over-the-counter drugs, prescription drugs, and drugs that are used only in research. Controlled substances are a subset, and you have in your handout something that explains much more in much more detail than this does which drugs are controlled substances, why they're controlled substances, and things like that. So I'm not going to spend any time on this slide because you have that.
Well, can we go back to that slide?
Certainly.
Which are the categories we're talking about?
In Senate Bill 34, Schedule 2, 3, and 4.
Can you just do that for a moment so we can just...
Certainly.
Okay, thank you.
So the prescription control substances, all of them account for less than 10% of all prescriptions dispensed, and this bill affects only approximately 9% of all prescriptions. So this is not all prescriptions, just a subset, those drugs that are subject to abuse and addiction.
Joseph, I hate to do this, but we have a witness that I'd like to hear who has to see patients at 5. Can we just hold this for a moment?
Certainly.
And ask Dr. Lace to come forward. I know he's going to be brief since he needs to get to his practice shortly. I'm sorry to have all this problem.
Representative Greenlick, members of the committee, my name is Jim Lace. I'm representing the Oregon Medical Association. We have worked extensively with Paige and with other people on this bill. And the idea and the concept is very important to us, and we know that there's abuse, and we know that there has to be some program in place. We had just two issues with this bill as we worked on the other side. One of them was addressed. There was a question of liability if a physician did not use the system to make sure that that physician was not going to be held liable for inadvertently prescribing medication, and that there's in the current legislation that is being addressed appropriately. The other issue is this issue about funding. This new information is just recent about how it's being funded. What I would like to use is a model that the state could look at. We currently have a vaccine registry system in our state. There's over 1 million vaccines that are given out in the state every year. We enter that data from our office into a computerized system. That information is available within 24 hours for anybody to query the system and to check it. It costs $0 to me as a physician to use that system. We pay our staff to put it in. And I would urge, as we look into this, and even though there's this $20, who knows what exactly the number is that would come back, out of the 12,500 physicians in the state, there's probably about 1,000 that would use this program over and over again. And I realize that we all should be using the program theoretically, depending upon what our practices are, but some people literally don't prescribe much in the way of pain meds or any of these controlled substances. So it's a little misleading to say that all physicians are going to be using that intensively, because a lot of us don't work with those kind of patients that we have to worry about with the abuse, even though we theoretically should be using them. So those are our two concerns with the bill, is that long-term funding, if in fact the state can come up with a different mechanism for funding this, the Oregon Medical Association strongly supports this bill, and we just want to make sure that it's not coming back on our side. On the Senate side, the testimony was is that the physicians would in fact be paying for the system. We're urging you that you don't have the physicians pay for it, and in fact, whether it's $20 or $500 or $1,000, the way the system is we'd rather not have that. We realize it may sound like we're a bunch of cheapskates, but we have a lot of other issues, and there's a number of physicians who do not do these things, and you have to realize that it's not just everybody that's out there. We have neonatologists who never write prescriptions, or radiologists, and the list goes on. So like I said, we went through the data. Out of the 12,500 active VME members, there's probably about 1,000 that would be using that system on a regular basis. So those are our two concerns, and we hope that those are appropriately addressed and not just sort of glossed over and said, we don't have to worry about that. So,
thank you. Are there any questions from Dr. Lace? Jim, thank you very much. Thanks. I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Not a problem. I understand.
I have two slides that are taken from the latest national survey on drug use and health that was done by the feds. It shows that the abuse and the non-medical use of pain relievers is second only to, almost identical with cocaine, second only to marijuana, but much higher than the use of heroin, stimulants, and other things. That's not all prescription drugs. That's just pain relievers. So there's definitely a problem. I also have this map that was compiled
go
by
back
them.
To that again.
Sure.
Which of those categories would be in this?
Pardon?
Which of those categories would be in this database?
The pain relievers, some of the tranquilizers, some of the stimulants, mm-hmm. and some of the sedatives.
Mm-hmm. Thank you.
This map was also compiled based on their survey data that shows the varying amounts of non-medical use of pain relievers, and you'll notice that a lot of Oregon is right there in the middle. Two areas of Oregon do show higher than average abuse or non-medical use of pain relievers over the past several years. So I've just put those in there to answer the question, well, is there really a problem with prescription drugs? This slide shows the states that have prescription monitoring programs, those that have enacted legislation but are not yet operational. The ones that are operational are maroon. The blue are have legislation but are not yet up and running. And the states in yellow are currently considering legislation. So this kind of gives you the landscape of prescription monitoring. These programs collect prescription data from pharmacies and assimilate it into information that's available for use by prescribers and by pharmacists who are treating patients. This prescription monitoring program is a tool for physicians and pharmacists. It helps them identify patients who have medical conditions from those individuals who are trying to scan them. It also helps them to monitor those legitimate patients. Helps with the public health initiatives of getting people who need drug abuse treatment into those drug abuse treatment programs and identify individuals who are at risk and perhaps prevent drug abuse by them. The value of this information to prescribers is it just gives them information. Is this patient going to other practitioners for controlled substances? Is the patient truthful when you do the history and physical? Do you have all the information you need to make a medical decision? And is this patient compliant with the treatment program that a current prescriber is giving to that patient? Now, federal law currently holds prescribers and pharmacists accountable and responsible for dispensing and prescribing only for legitimate medical conditions. Now, that right now the only way to obtain the information they need is to make phone calls and see other colleagues at meetings. So there's a scramble for information. It's inefficient, incomplete, and ineffective. And I have this drawing to show exactly what's going on. If you're trying to get information, you've got to try to go to all of the area pharmacies, and you're not going to pick up the ones out of the area. So everybody's trying to go everywhere, whereas if you have a prescription monitoring program, you have one centralized area for the prescribers and the pharmacists who are treating patients to obtain the information. People who have access to patient information through a prescription monitoring program already have access to this patient's information. The only difference is that the records are in one place with much greater security than in all of the pharmacies altogether. The issue of privacy always comes up. In 1979, the U.S. Supreme Court allowed the New York Prescription Monitoring Program to continue to operate and said it was not an automatic invasion of privacy. In the 90s, we had the HIPAA legislation, and HIPAA has exceptions that cover this prescription monitoring program, so it would be HIPAA compliant. There are also protections built into the state law. It restricts access to healthcare providers. It provides that this information is not a public record, and it further limits the retention of the patient's identification, such as their name. The data security in a prescription monitoring program, this data is more secure here than in most other places. Fewer people actually have access to the information through a prescription monitoring program than through the pharmacies. Prescribers and pharmacists are covered by HIPAA requirements and HIPAA penalties if they breach this confidentiality, and state law also provides penalties for breach of confidentiality. So the bottom line is what happens to a patient on a Friday night when they need or seek some medical treatment. If the physician gets a report from the prescription monitoring program, all they are getting is a list of prescriptions that the patient has received. It's not an assessment. It's not an evaluation. It's not a red flag saying don't treat this patient. It's just a list of prescriptions that they can use that information to help them evaluate that patient. We want that patient to have appropriate medical care. So if the patient goes into the emergency room and they're unconscious, they can't tell the prescriber what drugs they've been on and what their history is, and this will help them to take care of that unconscious patient in an appropriate manner. If it's a chronic pain patient that goes to the emergency room because they've had an accident or something and need emergency treatment, then it verifies the patient's information that they've given of what they're taking, what amounts, what frequency, what doctors they are seeing, so that that patient too can get appropriate medical care. And if the person who presents at the emergency room is a drug addict or a scammer in need of some fix or some drugs, they're just trying to scam to get the drugs, then the doctors can identify that person much more quickly, deal with them in an appropriate manner, and use their time resources on legitimate patients. I have some other resources that you can check out and get more information. You can also feel free to contact me at any time if you have questions about prescription monitoring programs in general.
We have a copy of your presentation.
I will make that available.
Thank you. Representative Miller?
Thank you. Issue of privacy. Currently, let's talk about Walgreens because they're nationwide. If a pharmacist in Florida wants to get information about a patient in Oregon, all they need to do currently, if they're a Walgreens patient, is go into their system, and they can access that information today on any patient in the state of Oregon. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so this system I think that's fine. There haven't been any issues of this, of misuse of that type of information. And so the issue of privacy, I think, is somewhat stretched.
Isn't there? I mean, right now, Dr. A doesn't have access to information about Dr. B's patient.
That is true.
Is that right? So this will now give Dr. A access to information about Dr. B's patient. That they would not have otherwise had.
Absolutely correct. But if Dr. A knows that patient is seeing Dr. B, it is appropriate for Dr. A to call Dr. B and say, you know, are you prescribing painkillers? Because we may have an issue here. And this.
Well, one of the things Dr. A doesn't have information about is that the patient is Dr. B's patient as well.
My point is, I'm supportive of this idea. The issue really comes around funding.
Great. Are there other questions?
Yes.
Senator Richards.
Thank you.
Are you jumping up and down, Representative Bonamici?
No,
you have
I'm
a question
just
too?
Readjusting. Thank you, Chair, for pointing that out.
You've reviewed Senate Bill 34, right?
Yes, I have.
And with your experience, can you tell us what areas we could improve in this bill?
Chairman Greenlee, Representative Richardson, Senate Bill 34 is a very good bill. I have looked at it. I made some early suggestions for some things to be added. That has all been incorporated. You have a very good bill here.
Thank you. Follow up. As you've studied what's happening in other states, can you tell us which would be the best one or two systems if we were going to not reinvent the wheel but look at other systems that are currently in place that are economical and efficient and accomplish the goal? What would be those locations?
Mr. Chair, Representative Richardson, I'm biased. I think we have a wonderful program in Ohio, and I intend to keep it that way. I would be happy to work with you on those issues. Nevada also has a good program. Utah has a longstanding program that they run very economically, and I can provide you many more contacts. There are a lot of good programs out there.
Thanks very much.
I do have a question, Mr. Chair.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Thank you for
your put some lights in.
Testimony. In the map and in your slideshow, you showed that Washington has a program, but it's my understanding that they recently turned down a proposal for a program. So I'm a little confused about that, and hope you can clarify that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, Washington State has had a program for many, many years. It is one of the oldest programs in the country, but it is different from every other program in the country in that right now they only monitor physicians whose practice has been restricted or being monitored by their licensing board. So they are only monitoring those. I believe the bill that they turned down would have been to expand that to all prescribers.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, would now be an appropriate time to ask a question to Ms. Clark as well?
Yes.
Thank you. Looking at the fiscal that we received, you have been the recipient of a $350,000 federal grant, but only $50,000 of that is available for you until before legislation is adopted. Is that correct?
That would be correct. And I do have my budget person here if you have specific questions for her. Yes.
Okay. But perhaps I'll follow up now, and if you don't know the answer, then we'll get the answer later. According to the LFO report here, the board has expended approximately $10,000 of the $50,000 for planning and has yet to develop a comprehensive plan. Why is that, and when can we expect a comprehensive plan?
Indeed. I'd like to invite Karen up here, please, McLean from the Board of Pharmacy, to address that excellent answer, Representative Cannon and Chair, and it would just be a very short, brief answer that we can follow up more with as well.
We'll get into this some more. Sure. Our intention is to bring this back with, we're just running out of time. We'll bring this back for a work session with invited testimony.
Thank you.
Spend some more time with it.
Do you want me to respond?
Please.
Okay. Committee members, my name is Karen McLean. I'm the Administrative Director for the Oregon Board of Pharmacy. Part of the Board of Pharmacy's intent of our goal was to try to restrict expenditures through the planning funds in order to maintain all of the expenditures that we had once we could, so that we could implement the program adequately to fund it for the full 2 years of 07-09. We do have a plan. I have put together information that is in the pink packet. I've provided this on a variety of different occasions and a variety of different formats. It's this purple sheet of paper that's the second page in the pink packet that gives a timeline and a plan for the types of activities that we'll be doing over the course of the next 24 months. That is the expectation. The biggest expenditure associated with this program is with staffing. And so we have tried to take a look at that and see how would we roll out our funds most efficiently and effectively in order to use what we have available, but also be able to get the program up and running and use it within the period of time that we have available to us through the grant.
Mr. Chair, I'm not sure that my question was answered, but I would also like maybe to hold that conversation off till we get a better sense of the fiscal situation here.
That'd be great, yeah. And I think we'll bring LFO in to help us, too. Thank you both very much. Andrea?
Thank you, Chair Greenlick, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, Legislative Director for the ACLU of Oregon. This is the first time I've appeared in front of you this session, and I am here in opposition to Senate Bill 34. It's an issue that I've been following over 6 years, as this legislation has been put forward a number of years. It was indeed Senator John Minnis who first called me in with concerns about this legislation some 6 years ago. Senate Bill 34 creates a government-monitored database in Oregon on our lawful prescriptions. It interferes with our patient and doctor relationship. It puts our medical and personal identifying information at risk. It provides us with no remedy if we are wrongly identified. It gives us no recourse if the state or anyone else releases our data. It interferes with our lawful private medical decisions and in turns all of us into potential drug-seeking individuals when yet it has been testified to that we're talking about a discrete population. We all become that. I've been talking to the community and folks for 6 years on this issue, and I have not encountered one person when I tell them the well-intentioned purpose of this bill, that they are not alarmed to know that the government will be databasing and monitoring their lawful prescription use. The list of drugs is often, it's controlled substances, schedules 2, 3, and 4. Now, I certainly didn't know what that meant, but assumed that it was pretty unlikely that I would ever take drugs like that. But this includes commonly prescribed drugs such as Ambien, Xanax, any codeine product like cough syrup, and Ritalin, which is prescribed to children. The pharmacy board testified on the other side that they estimate logging 2 to 5 million, maybe more, prescriptions a year. And our state population is only about 3.5 million. Many of us choose not to share with our family or our friends the prescriptions we are on and our medical conditions. For those who choose to do so, that's their choice. But for those who don't, it is puts this information at risk that it could be disclosed. You know, former, well, deceased Supreme Court Justice Brandeis in 1890 said about privacy, it is the most comprehensive of rights and the most valued by civilized man. Now, the government desires to use technology as it expands in our society, and it's well-intentioned often with a desire to use it. But the effect is an erosion and government of our privacy and of our personal information and government intrusion into our lawful activities. Now, they're talking about a database. A lot of information has been given you today. A lot of it's new to us, even though we've been raising these questions for years. I heard one of the senators testify that it will be online. I'm not sure how the system is going to be run, but I can tell you that the risk of security breaches when you create a database is extremely high, and it can be done through online, emails, data transmission, hacking, compromised passwords, stolen equipment, lost equipment, illegitimate access by former employees, or dishonest insiders. Now, every time I testify on this, I go look and see what the latest number of breaches are, security breaches across this country, and I just limited it to 2007. And in the 120 days or so of this year, there have been 112 breaches across the country. Of those, over 20 have to do with healthcare information, healthcare practitioners. I believe it's on page 3 of my testimony, and because we're running short of time, I was very tempted to read the extremely long list of only the healthcare provider information that's been released. But it is alarming when you read that list from Blue Cross Blue Shield to the Department of Veterans Affairs to hospitals from the East Coast to the West Coast, from Seattle, pharmacy information, private vendors, public entities. It goes on and on. Now, it's been testified to, and they've often said, well, there's been no release of these pharmacy databases. Well, I'm not sure that we would know. California was the first state, and the reason we often now know that there are data breaches is because they had a state law that required that their citizens be notified when there was a breach. But I don't know what states have a duty to report the breach to folks. And if your identity and information is stolen, you might not know the originating source. So to say that there's been no breach yet doesn't give us a lot of good feeling, and I'm not sure that we truly know the answer. Now, I want to talk about the financial issues. There has been a real lack of money and a lack of planning. Now, you've been given today this timeline, but what you haven't been given is the money allocation, except for this $300,000 that we've been told. And I want to quote the first Legislative Fiscal Office's analysis of the $300,000 and the information put by the Board of Pharmacy, which is dated by LFO March 12th. So this has been a long time this issue has been working, and as of March 12th, LFO made the following statement. The board's fiscal impact is premised on the $300,000 of federal grants funding it has received rather than a clearly articulated plan and associated budget detailing how the data will be acquired, validated, managed, stored, secured, and analyzed. Thus, the actual cost of this measure, both for 07-09 biennium as well as beyond, is uncertain. I have yet to see anything that gives us any sense that there is yet to be a plan, particularly regarding the database. Now, I have attached to my testimony the Washington fiscal for a bill that was similar that they did not go forward with, and I'm glad that there was a question. I've been testifying that Washington doesn't have this kind of database for years, and yet that purple map still stays purple with them, that they are marked as having this database, and it's not true, as you've now heard testimony. They estimated a $2.1 million fiscal, and you've heard testimony that a lot of that had to do with FTE staff people. Well, likewise, Washington said that the Harold Rogers grant was not enough. But let's not even talk about the 10 FTEs. Let's look at Washington's recognition of the need to provide a secure database, something that gets completely ignored despite the testimony I've brought up year after year. Washington fiscal said $250,000 for the first 2 years of hardware, with an additional $248,000 to be anticipated after 3 years. For software, it estimated a $70,000 cost with an annual $14,000 upgrade. And yet, the Pharmacy Board of Oregon keeps focusing most of their money on personnel. Of the $300,000, the information they gave LFO was basically $255,000 of that would be for personnel, leaving apparently $44,000 for 2 years to run and implement the whole program and a database. Now, the new LFO that you have received focuses on delays of starting the cost, delays of starting the program, delays of hiring people. But the cost, according to LFO, still remains uncertain. There is a suggestion in this statement that the state will contract out with a vendor for this database, not purchasing itself. Now, despite the $50,000 grant, there's been no planning, and we don't even know yet what that means and what they anticipate purchasing, and haven't been able to present that information. But to contract out the database raises significant concerns to us. First, we've only got a limited amount of funds, and yet any third-party private business, part of the money will be for their profit margin. So we can count part of the money that we're going to spend on the database to go to the third-party business sector for their profit. The remaining, hopefully, will buy us something. Additionally, if it is an outside vendor, we've got additional transmission of information outside the board. Now you've got the board, the doctor, the pharmacist, and a third-party vendor involved, which we have no direct oversight of its employees. Now, I find it interesting that the Board of Pharmacy presents to you today, in fact, in their main testimony, that they're not using Social Security numbers as an identifier. With all due respect, their legislation did not prohibit that, indeed hid that, in rulemaking authority, and it was only when the ACLU intervened on the Senate side did Senator Morissette put forward an amendment making explicitly clear that you could not use Social Security number. I have been testifying to that concern year after year, but our Board of Pharmacy has not seen fit to decide that that was an important enough safeguard that they put in themselves in the originating legislation. It suggests to me that the concerns of privacy protection, unique identifiers, is not going to be addressed. With all due respect, the track record of the Board of Pharmacy in terms of our privacy protections is alarming. In 2005, Gary Schnabel, on behalf of the board, talked about the Drug Alert publication that they did to collect names of suspected drug abusers. It was only when the Attorney General intervened, saying publicly distributing information that is damaging to people who have never been charged with any crime was probably a problem, and indeed probably violated HIPAA. Now, I want to talk about the law enforcement piece because a new information's coming forward to us in looking at this. In addition, they talk about, well, we've addressed the ACLU concerns with law enforcement because there's a court order. Well, first of all, it doesn't prohibit law enforcement from getting a court order, and if they suspect someone, they've got probable cause, they can get the court order to get the records. So, yes, certainly having a court order is a safeguard. But the federal government, the FBI, and the DEA, as you may have heard in the news recently, have other resources to get information, including our medical information, without a court order. And those are called national security letters. And we know from recent information that the FBI has used those far more extensively than even Congress, and I believe the head of the FBI, anticipated should be used. So there are ways to get information, including private medical information, without a court order. Now, you will hear and have heard testimony about this really isn't law enforcement. We're here for intervention. Mr. Schnabel, on February 24, 2005, testified before this body that the third objective of this program is to develop greater understanding and coordination of efforts between healthcare and medical practitioners and law enforcement personnel. Now, I think it's important to recognize that the grant received from the federal government is through the Department of Justice, which is the law enforcement arm, not the Health and Human Services. In a review of programs that I've just done in the last day, and I attached at the last page of my testimony in that folder piece, but I'm going to summarize, shows that a number of states that are using this program are using it for law enforcement purposes. Let's first look at some of the entities running these programs in other states. In California, the program is run by the Department of Justice Bureau of Narcotics Enforcement. In New York, it is the New York Bureau of Narcotic Enforcement. And in Oklahoma, it's the Bureau of Narcotics and Dangerous Drugs. Now, information through September 2006 from the National Alliance of Model State Drug Laws also reveals a relationship between these databases and law enforcement. So they looked at the queries. Who is asking? Pharmacists, doctors, law enforcement. In Idaho, 70% of the requests were law enforcement. In Illinois, it was 50%. In Indiana and Pennsylvania, all of the requests at that time were for law enforcement purposes. Massachusetts, 61%. Mississippi, 50%. And Oklahoma, 50%. Far from focusing on drug intervention, this program has been used in other states to focus on law enforcement intervention. The proponents again talk about this purpose is for...
You want to wind it up?
I am. Is for intervention. But there's no money here for drug treatment. They also don't address what happens when you are wrongly identified. You've had new information today about how this is all going to be accurate. I haven't been able to follow that whole thread and how this information is going to be accurate. But you are supposed to have a unique identifier, and it can't be your Social Security number. And if it's Friday night and you show up at the pharmacy with your loved one to get in for medicine, and the pharmacist says, "We're sorry, we can't prescribe this and turn this drug over to you because they're already in the database with this drug, and we can't give it to you," what are you going to do? Wait to call the pharmacy board on Monday? What if it's wrongly released? If the request wasn't supposed to be for you, you'll never know that your medical information was provided or released to someone else. They're retaining the data on you. They refuse to have any amendments to limitations. They talk about release to other states. With all due respect to the previous testimony, when it was suggested that Oregon's going to have the best plan, I haven't seen that. We haven't seen how the best plan is going to have a database that's secure, and yet we're already going to share it with other states that have equivalent security protections. Finally, there's immunity given to everyone involved, including the state government, for any breaches as long as there was a good faith effort. So there's no recourse for you if you are damaged by any of this. And that certainly is an alarming problem to us when the government can do that. We also believe there's a conflict of interest with the grants. They can get grants from private sectors, and I would suggest that they are probably going to look to grants to maybe those folks who run these kind of databases. And that raises a conflict of interest. This program is not ready. You are only getting information today that we have never had after months and years of their having the opportunity and the monies available to put the planning forward to you and to all of us so that we can fully evaluate the consequences. It's not been done, and I urge you not to pass it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. I guess my question would be, could you provide, and you don't need to do it now, but specific suggestions on how we can improve the bill? I mean, I think there are some benefits in this bill. I think you raised some good points, especially about having, what recourse you have if the information is incorrect. I'm also very aware of how we use our immunization alert system in the state. It provides I look at that as a similar type of model of trying to make sure that everybody knows what immunizations are out there, whether it's a physician or a school. There's some benefit there. So I guess I would just ask, if you have specific changes to the bill to make it stronger to address some of your issues around whichever one, I'd be happy to look at those. And I'm just wondering if you can provide some of that.
Chair Gudenick, Representative Kotek, certainly the immunity needs to be fixed, the retention needs to be fixed, but there's a lot I simply don't know. I have no idea. There needs to be money for a database. Again, look at Washington State. That was the bells and whistles, I'm told, that they have, and yet close to $500,000 allocated for a database structure and running, and I've not seen anything, and I have no idea how our database is going to be run, who's going to do it. I don't know how to help not amendments to do that.
If I could just follow up on that. I understand some of the details of how it would be implemented is not clear in the bill, but that doesn't – rarely is that outlined distinctly in statute. I think there's a lot of detail here. I think if we might have to set up an advisory group, and I think there's one in here, if we need stronger description or intention in rulemaking around what that database should look like, I think that's a fine suggestion. I think it's the fiscal aspect and the actual implementation, I think, is a difficult thing. That, to me, that's a somewhat separate argument than the framework of what's being proposed in the statute. And so I'd like to keep them somewhat separate. I understand there are budgetary issues. I understand there are details of implementation. I'm more concerned about, is the bill address the issues that we need to address in the statute? So I just want to make that clarification.
Andrew, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd like to call Blake Rice, Robert Pearson, is it? And Shelda Holmes. And if we have time, the next group will be Karen Wheeler, and I'd like to have time, Ann Euler, and Jim Thompson. Chuck? Please go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Blake Rice. I'm a pharmacist from Douglas County. drove up here because I think Senate Bill 34 is a good thing to have. I've been a pharmacist for many years. I did spend some time on the Board of Pharmacy and was involved 8 years ago when I discovered the Kentucky monitoring program. I'm from a rural part of the state. Representative Maurer's from that same part of the state. He knows that we're in a bad area for children and other people getting these drugs illegally and using them for everything from the farm parties that they talked about earlier today. I'm sure you guys are already aware of that. I'm also a father. I have kids in school. I still have kids in high school. I have kids in college. And they come home, my daughter comes home from college and talks about the farm parties they have, and they buy the drugs on the street. They buy the Vicodin, they buy the oxycodone, they buy it on the street from people that got the prescriptions, you know, for not a medical reason. I have calls from the resource officers at all the little schools around us. Tiller called, can you identify a tablet for me? And it's Vicodin or it's Norco. It's alarming to me that these kids are able to access that at that young of age. I just can't imagine a grade school kid even thinking about a farm party, but they do that. Senate Bill 34 allows Oregon to get on the bandwagon with the 32 other states. There are states that are operating successful programs. Kentucky's is good. Ohio's is a great program. Nevada's program is good. I've looked at all their programs. We need to have this in Oregon. The repercussions for my area are huge. We addressed the methamphetamine problem with the Sudafed bill, and it's done wonders. I talked to Dr. Sheriff Brown in Douglas County routinely, and we've had months and months where we haven't had a mom and pop meth house bust in our county. They just haven't happened. I never thought Sudafed was a problem. I was a pharmacist and never thought it was a problem until a house blew up two blocks from my store. And it wasn't from Sudafed they bought from my store. It was actually came from a big box store. They were able to put in a whole case of stuff. Blew out the whole back into their house. I didn't even know we had a problem. I'm sorry. Anyway, Senate Bill 34 addresses a huge problem. These ill-gotten prescription drugs are also the currency of illegal drugs in our area. It's a huge problem. I'll let someone else.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Shelda Holmes, and I'm testifying in support of Senate Bill 34. You've heard a lot of MD and physician talk. I'm a nurse practitioner, and I'm a family nurse practitioner and a small business owner. I have a clinic in Inner North, Northeast Portland. I'm the other red spot on the map, as is Representative Kotek. I also have a great deal of experience with mental health and addictions treatment. My brother struggled with addiction since he was 14 years old. And only in the last few years have I realized that actually a lot of these painkillers are being used to supplement. They're being used as the downside of the ephedrine upside. It's a dangerous cocktail. A lot of people
use. I was also an oncology and bone marrow transplant nurse in the hospital several years before going into advanced practice. I became a nurse in the era of pain is the sixth vital sign. So I have always found it very important to treat pain. And that being said, that's just some background. I have had prescription pads stolen from me, photocopied. I have seen my patients pass their medications and prescriptions to others in the parking lot 5 minutes after I left them. I have had elderly patients with medications that have been stolen from them by their grandchildren and children. In December 2005, one of my patients tried to kill himself with a narcotic overdose. When I spoke with an ICU nurse, not HIPAA-compliant interaction, I was told my prescription was only one out of nine that were found at the scene. He had been squirreling for some time. But what I see most often is the expert drug seeker. That's the person that picks one pharmacy per PCP, one pharmacy per prescriber. And so, again, this is referencing, you know, the silos that we're operating in. Well, my testimony is personal. I'm also a member of the Oregon Nurses Association, in particular the Nurse Practitioners of Oregon, and ONA supports Senate Bill 34. As a family nurse practitioner, I provide care to patients of all ages and stages of life. I have an independent scope of practice. That is to say, I do not practice under any other clinician. My scope of practice includes controlled substances and prescription privilege. In today's healthcare climate, where, as a primary care provider, I am expected to see 22 to 26 patients a day in 10 to 15-minute spots, and it is very difficult to provide good care, even under the best of circumstances. It is then extraordinarily difficult to determine whether a patient is drug-seeking, drug-diverting, and or living with chronic pain. Not that any of these are mutually exclusive. It's complicated. It is especially true that in the underserved and Medicaid populations, because these patients receive hit-and-miss health care, coverage and health care. In addition, Medicaid coverage for chronic non-malignant pain is so grossly inadequate that as a primary care provider, narcotics are often my only intervention. There's no physical therapy, chiropractic, massage, this sort of stuff. Every patient that mentions pain that comes to see me as a new patient, automatically I raise an eyebrow. Always. If the patient doesn't disclose when or from whom they have recently received health care, I raise another eyebrow. And as you can imagine, any of those patients who have traveled more than 20 minutes or two buses from my clinic are at high level of suspicion. Drug seeking is immediately on my diagnostic differential with every patient that mentions pain. That's the state of my practice. That's healthcare right now. Senate Bill 34 will be a very important tool to my practice. It will immediately cut my labor costs. I can't even quantify the amount of time I spend paying salaries for folks to sleuth information. It'll cut my worry and suspicion, of course. But let me break it down for you just quickly, and I'm almost finished with my testimony. Every patient that receives controlled medication from me is put on a medication contract. That lists what medications they're receiving, why, what pharmacy they're going to use. I have to notify all the emergency rooms in the area of my patient's contract with me. A mandate that they come see me every 30 days for a prescription refill, and I urine drug screen them. Very, very costly. And I spend hours and hours calling pharmacies and sleuthing information. I foresee this database to make much-needed improvements in patient care. I want to help those patients of mine who have drug addiction problems. I want to protect vulnerable patients that are being taken advantage of, and I most certainly want to treat patients with pain. In healthcare, providers are constantly weighing the risks and benefits, and this is, you know, the subjective art to our science. I would simply like to be a bit more objective in that science. A database allows us to quantify medication, pharmacy, and prescriber use. It will prove to be a very important tool. Lastly, I would gladly pay a nominal fee to support a database like this. That's for y'all to figure out. But in the end, it would definitely save me money. And as a clinician, and a business owner, and a taxpayer, frankly, But most importantly, it'll be a tool to provide better patient care. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I urge this committee to support Senate Bill 34.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, I'm Dr. Robert Peterson. I come from Clatsop County. I'm a physician. I'm a medical director of the Federally Qualified Health Center in Astoria. And I have a wide background in understanding the use of narcotics, dealing with patients who need narcotics, dealing with patients who think they need narcotics or other substances. And I can hardly agree with the evidence supporting the bill that's been presented so far. I'd like to add, I've been a hospice medical director. I've been a medical oncologist. I'm now a primary care physician. And the patients I take care of are the Medicaid patients and the folks with no insurance in Clatsop County. And there is nobody else who will see Medicaid patients in Clatsop County except for our clinic at this time. Unfortunately, these patients also tend to have a fair number, risk-wise, of being folks that might abuse or divert drugs. But I can tell you that if the patients come to our clinic that I am suspicious of, a fair number of them actually have decent insurance. They come to us because they think they might be able to get medication from us that they won't get elsewhere because many of the other physicians in our town won't prescribe pain medications. Whether the patients really need them or not, if it's a new patient that they don't understand and they don't have records for. This bill is one piece in the puzzle for trying to deal with this kind of problem, but it's a very important piece. When we don't have this kind of information available to us and we have a patient we're concerned about, we try to call as many pharmacies in the area as we can. Unfortunately, we don't always come to our attention that a patient is somebody we should be worrying about before it's too late. The last quarter of 2006, there were 5 deaths in our county related to prescription drug abuse. Some were overdoses, some were motor vehicle accidents. Some of the injuries were not the drug abusers, but their motor vehicle accident victims as well. So if we do not get a good way to handle this problem, there will continue to be more people dying, more people injured, and it's a significant problem. We're a small county, and if we lost 5 people in 2 or 3 months, imagine what's really going on in the rest of the state. You don't often see those statistics coming out of the police department about whether there were dirigy patches on the backs of the folk who fell asleep at the wheel and ran into the tree that ran off the road. But our medical examiner knows about these cases. If we are able to identify these people before they've escalated to the point of hurting themselves, we can cut back on giving them stuff that's going to hurt them, and we can direct them to places where they might receive help. Without being able to find this, we can't. There are 1,000 more things I could say, but this is just an important thing. It's not just a matter of whether or not the drugs are being diverted and whether they're available in the schools or not. People are dying from this. It's my 11-year-old girl knows who in her school who you can get drugs from farming. This is in middle school. It's not just a little problem.
Dr. Peterson, thank you very much for coming. Mr. Rice, thank you very much, Sheldon. I'm just going to hear from one more witness, if you bring him in. We have a patient who would like to talk to us. I think it would be useful to hear from him. The third panel I asked, we will have another work session on this. I do want to make sure that that Jim Thompson and Karen Wheeler and Ann Euler, please try and come back for that. I really apologize for others of you that have come so far to talk to us and haven't had the opportunity. Mr. O'Neill, will you please join us in the front? Please identify yourself.
Hi, Mr. Chairman, Council people. My name is Dan O'Neill. I represent the American Pain Foundation, their advisory council. I will take my 3 minutes, I promise. I'm a chronic pain patient. I've been on Schedule II medications for 4 years. It's because of a job injury. For those of you who don't understand what a Schedule II or III medication is, let me clarify. I guess it already has been, but they're typically what we call opiates, medications like morphine, methadone, OxyContin, Percodin, Vicodin, etc. These are bad words to some people. It's just a typical drug used for chronic and intractable pain. I'm a person not unlike a diabetic in the fact that I'm dependent on my medication to function. There are millions of people like myself that are law-abiding citizens, and we follow the rules set forth by our physicians to a T. I find it very disturbing to hear about the 3 or 4% out there that abuse the system. This bill will do so much good for us. I can't express enough how we need this bill to pass. I can hear the naysayers now crying out, "Big Brother is watching us." I'm sorry, but that attitude is just a plain lame excuse to complain about something. If you have nothing to hide, this bill doesn't have anything that will infringe on your rights. Nothing. It'll help our physicians to be able to write prescriptions more often to help people that are in need of this kind of treatment. The doctors and the pharmacists will not have to wonder if they're being scammed by some doc shoppers. If the doctor and the pharmacist have the slightest doubt that you're an abuser, you know, they can go to this database and voila, you know, you're brought up. It will show that you're using Schedule II, Schedule III medications, whatever the schedule is. I doubt seriously we're going to be worrying about such trivial medications as somebody else mentioned here today. But let's please go forward with this bill. And, you know, so that we can be without suspicion by the professionals. This database is only accessible by doctors and pharmacists. Let me repeat. It's only accessible by doctors and pharmacists. If law enforcement wants to access it, the only way they're going to get it is through a warrant. So I'd like to end in restating the fact this is a good bill and good will come from it. Thank you for hearing me.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks for coming. Are there any questions? We have heard in a lot of earlier discussions that how hard it is for people with chronic pain to get medication because they're viewed as suspicious, in the sense that this might help that, might ease that, is what you're saying to us, huh?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much for your testimony.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Will they be able to come back? Would they rather come back or just wait right now?
They will come back. We have an anesthesiology clinic here that cannot come back. Can you hear those three physicians real quickly?
Yeah, very quickly.
Okay. You'll come back? Okay, you guys, you can come back?
If you want to. We'll come back.
Oh, it's
driving. Thank you all. Appreciate that.
Well, does the military family want to testify now or they want to come back?
Okay,
let's do it now.
I will try to be quick.
Other members of the committee have said they'll listen to the tape for the rest of the session. So
okay, thank you.
You will be heard by more members of the committee, and I really apologize for how long we've run, including to the committee.
I guess so. Thank you, Chair Greenlick and committee members, for giving your attention to this very important bill for Oregon. I believe that had this bill been in place in our state,
Please identify yourself.
Oh, my name is Eva Gompers, and this is my husband, Commander Jerry Gompers.
If he's going to talk, he'll identify himself.
No, he's not going to talk.
He just
it's just support.
I believe had this bill been in place in our state providing this tool to doctors and pharmacists that my son would be alive today. Although this is very difficult for my husband, Commander Jerry Gompers, who has just returned from his tour in Iraq, and myself, I come before you to share the tragic story of my son, Daniel Nathan Gompers, who died 1 year and 2 days ago from an overdose of the drug Vicodin. Vicodin is a prescription-controlled substance that I have learned is often abused, sold, bartered, and traded on our streets, and is readily prescribed by doctors after procedures or surgery or for pain. Danny's death certificate stated his death was caused by toxicity from hydrocodone. I will summarize for you his struggles with addiction to prescription drugs. As you are hearing his story, please remember that he was a handsome young man who tried his best to move on with his life. He was very much loved and valued by his family and friends. Danny struggled with prescription drug addiction. His preferred drugs were Oxycontin, Vicodin, and the benzodiazepines, Xanax, Klonopin, Valium, and other lesser classified controlled substances in categories 3 and 4 of the drug categories. He used powerful drugs and those considered to be less so, based on the prescription drug categories. Do not think that only drugs in the highest Schedule 2 are a danger. Danny didn't abuse illegal drugs. He didn't have to. He was able to access these prescription drugs through prescriptions written by multiple doctors. He frequented different pharmacies. He knew how to present himself well to the doctors and nurse practitioners who saw him. He was charming and well-groomed. Danny became addicted to prescription drugs when he was a college student in the 2001-2002 school year. The drugs were easy to access and very popular with the young students. He would go to hospital emergency rooms, urgent care centers, and various doctors to get prescriptions. In June of 2004, he hit rock bottom, receiving a DUI and having his license suspended because he was under the influence of Valium, a class 4 controlled substance. Danny struggled with mental illness and addiction. His situation was very challenging to our family and everyone who loved him. He was in and out of several insurance plans and several treatment programs. No one could help him, partly because he could simply find a new prescriber to supply him with his drugs of choice. In some cases, some drugs can be run through on an insurance plan, and some might be purchased with cash and not show up on the insurance. These prescribers, clinics, emergency rooms, and offices did not have any way to determine if there were multiple people giving my son drugs. Danny overdosed many times. I would find Xanax, a controlled substance, class 4, hidden in his jacket. We would find Vicodin tucked into a drawer and more prescription controlled substances hidden in various places, many of them from multiple doctors. Danny did get a job in February 2006, but he continued to relapse. In March 2006, he went doctor shopping and was prescribed Xanax and the sleeping drug Ambien by a family practitioner locally. Danny overdosed on the Xanax, which sent him to the hospital. On Monday morning, May 1st, 2006, my handsome, well-spoken son went to yet another doctor seeking prescriptions. After his death the following day, when the coroner took his body away from his home for the last time ever in a black plastic body bag, I found a bottle of pills hidden in his snowboarding boot. When I tracked down the prescriber, I was told that she said that she believed the patient, and when she asked the doctor's supervisor in the back of the office, she was told to believe the patient also. The fact was that because he could present himself well, he didn't fit the stereotype of an addict. These prescribers are simply relying on their impressions rather than comprehensive prescribing records. The system did not give my son the protection from this illness that he so desperately needed. As long as there is no system in place that can provide prescribers and pharmacists with the ability to know a person's doctor shopping and pharmacy hopping, more doctors will be a part of feeding addictions and more people will continue to die. I have no doubt in my mind that if Senate Bill 34 was in effect, that my beautiful, beloved son will be alive today. We have to live with our grief over losing him for the rest of our lives. If Danny had died from a heroin or cocaine overdose, and we knew who supplied it to him, that dealer would have been arrested. As it is, we struggle with knowing that a simple communication tool to provide a complete patient pharmacy record could have helped save our son. It is too late for my son, Danny, but I know that the abuse of prescription drugs is rampant throughout the country, and that at least 32 other states already have this program or are putting it in place. Please, 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 this bill needs to be in place in Oregon to honor my son's memory, to know that his life mattered, and that his death would help others save others with the same struggles. Please see that Senate Bill 34 becomes law here in the state of Oregon. Respectfully, Eva Gompers, Danny's mom.
Thank you, Mrs. Gompers. Any questions? Mm-hmm. Thank you. Thank you very much for sharing your story. I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 34 and Senate Bill 34, and we'll be back in work session perhaps with some more testimony. And have a good weekend. Thank you all so much for coming. Well, I mean.